Donovan and Ms. Fitzgerald. Hello?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Donovan.
This is Mark Donovan.
Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
2 minutes would be preferred, Your Honor.
All right. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I do want to again apologize for the incident last week where Mr. Baker, co-counsel in this case, who's not present on this phone call, failed to appear in Lexington for the appointed time to argue this case. So I want to thank the Court and Your Honors for allowing us to do this and also apologize to Ms. Fitzgerald, who I spoke to earlier today about this. Your Honor, this particular case is a fairly narrow issue at this point, the assignment of error that remains. It is, of course, under 46.2894, and the principal argument here is that the statutory changes that occurred in 2005 in the legislation that passed in 2005 House bill, that the intent of the legislature clearly shows that they are narrowing the types of cases that would be ultimately felony versus misdemeanor. And the specific language, of course, was changed to more than $1,000 of damage to property, striking accidents resulting in damage to property valued at $1,000 or more, which would, of course, limit the number of cases in theory.
Counsel, this is Judge Russell. My read of that change, though, is that it wants to go to the amount of damage, not the item damaged. For example, a $5 scratch on my daughter's bicycle should be treated criminally the same way as a $5 scratch on a $100,000 Mercedes. But it seems to me if that's the intent of the change, it doesn't necessarily assist your argument, because the question then just becomes, was $1,000 of damage done to whatever the item was?
Well, that is correct, Your Honor, but I think that in doing so, I think both can exist. I think that your hypothetical is correct, and it's part of our argument, frankly, that I'm looking at it a different way, perhaps, but that the
Let's focus in just a little bit. There was testimony that the damage to the vehicle exceeded $1,000. Why doesn't that answer the whole question?
Because, Your Honors, we're looking at this as the definition and distinction of what damage is. And I know that it has been raised, and it was raised at the trial court level by Honorable Judge Cook. It was also raised by the Commonwealth on their brief. The Avery case, which is a civil case, which defines damage as it relates to that particular automobile accident and personal property. But this is a different standard altogether, a different type of case. And so we feel that the damage associated in a hit-and-run incident going from misdemeanor to felony is vastly different than the damage defined in the Avery case and in subsequent cases in the civil realm.
Let me point you to another statute, 18.2-137, which is, among other things, damaging personal property, and it's a criminal case, a criminal statute, and it has that $1,000 threshold, and that statute says that the damage may be established by proof of the fair market cost of repair or fair market replacement value. So clearly, the General Assembly did not intend to establish some different way of determining value in a criminal case than it announced in the Supreme Court announced in Everett in a civil case.
I'm not arguing that, Your Honor. I think that this is just one of those cases that certainly has no controlling authority historically on this specific issue. I don't deny that there's the other statute addressing the replacement value, and I think there was a case, Bailey Jr. versus the Commonwealth, very recently, that sort of took up an expert's, or rather a lay witness, the complaining witness's testimony regarding the value. It was a bicycle, I think a $500 bike, and he said it was a $500 bike. That's a little bit different than what we have here. I guess what we're getting at, Judge, is that it's our argument that there are really three parts to this. There's parts labor, there's frame labor, and there's parts. And there's such subjective nature to the labor components of those particular repairs. First of all, there were three separate estimates. There was the first estimate, the supplement, and the final estimate, none of which had $1,000 of parts to repair the vehicle. And part of our argument, Your Honor, is that potentially a labor shop up in, an auto body shop in Loudoun County is going to be a lot different than my uncle's shop in Buckingham. I'm pretty sure the labor would be significantly different. And so we're seeking to have a distinction here, hopefully creating some uniformity across the Commonwealth of Virginia. And it appears,
But couldn't the cost of parts vary? I mean, whatever you select, I mean, isn't the market price going to be driven by location? So you wouldn't get uniformity.
That's pretty accurate, Your Honor. I would, in part of our possible rebuttal to the argument that there was no competing evidence, refer you to page 55 of the appendix. And we were asking Joel Damiani that the questions regarding the vendors and where he purchased the particular parts. And the question was posed, but you could search other vendors. In this case, you didn't. I could, yes. And so that's accurate, but I think it sort of tends to follow our argument, Your Honor, that there's a lot of differences between body shops. And now that this particular body shop was chosen at a number that just clipped over the $1,000 mark, perhaps if she had gone to one down the street, we're looking at a man that's convicted of a misdemeanor versus a felon.
But, Mr. Donovan, you didn't put on any evidence to rebut the testimony of the expert witnesses put on the Commonwealth. There's no dispute in the record that is the cost of repairing the vehicle. So all of your argument about there could have been cheaper parts or labor might not have been expensive, none of that evidence is before us.
Well,
that's supposition.
Your Honor, I would only just direct you to page 55 to that extent, because I did note that in the brief of the appellee, that there is the competing evidence in the way of the question of the fact that they could have gone to different vendors. But I'd also say this, Your Honor, regarding rebutting the evidence, it would be almost an impossibility to properly rebut the evidence from the standpoint that after the car has been fixed, we can't disassemble it and have another expert look at the damage and assess it and determine what the labor would be and the cost of the parts would be after the fact. So that's part of the problem with this particular case, and probably a lot of cases from here on out, is that once this particular body shop is selected, that is it. There's no way to necessarily go back and find a cheaper alternative.
Counsel, in civil cases, that happens all the time, that somebody comes in with an expert who says, no, the actual cost to repair the car to its pre-crash function was only X, and they didn't need to do X, Y, and Z, or this price is out of line for the local market. That happens all the time in civil cases. Why wouldn't that be permissible and possible in a criminal case?
I guess maybe impossible is too strong a word, and I apologize for using that. Certainly there could be an expert that could come in and render an opinion based upon the review of the file and possibly an examination of the car, even if it's already fixed, just on the basis of what is reported both on document and testimony. But not the issue there is, in this particular case, when we have $400 over the $1,000 mark, we are dealing with a very narrow range. And for an expert to come back in and assess that particular damage, I think it would be different. And I'd also say this, with regards to the civil cases, such as Averett versus the criminal cases, the standard in a civil case, certainly in that particular type of case, would be to make the person whole. That's not the standard, that's not what this statute, the criminal statute 46.2, is seeking to do. That's making a distinction.
Well, a person is only made whole up to the amount of damage is done. Whether they're being made whole or not, the question is, what are the amount of damages?
I understand that, Your Honor, and I'm sort of arguing something beyond that. I think that this particular statute, 46.2894, creates an elevation based upon a specific dollar amount, whether it's arbitrary or not. And when the civil case, we don't have that elevation. So it doesn't go to $1,000 and suddenly there's double recovery. It's not like that with the civil cases. So certainly it would make sense for juries and judges to find as much in the way of damages as possible to make the person whole. But it's a, I guess it's what I'm trying to distinguish from the civil side to the criminal side.
How would you propose that we draw a rule on establishing damages in a case like this?
Well, Judge, I think that's it's a difficult question. I think the only fair way to do it, and we've sort of tried to outline this in our brief, the only fair way to look at the damages in this particular type of case would be the most objective component of it, and that would be the parts. When you get into the labor, as we've stated, you do have a lot of different areas of the Commonwealth, some more affluent than others, some that would charge much greater labor costs than others, and that would certainly factor into whether a person might be convicted of a misdemeanor or felony.
Have you got any legal argument to support that? Any cases, anything to suggest that would be the intent of the General Assembly? I mean, something we can hang our hat on.
Judge, and I wish we had more than we do, but the only thing we do have is the actual House bill, and that's, I know, not legal authority, but the House bill shows, the summary as introduced says, rewords the penalty portion of the law on leaving the scene of an accident to clarify that in cases where property is damaged in an accident, the severity of the penalty depends on the amount of the damage caused, not the value of the property that was damaged. And so going back to Judge Russell's original question, or hypothetical, it certainly could be construed only as that, but it certainly is a move to reduce the number of individuals who would be potentially convicted of felony versus of misdemeanors. And finally, Your Honor, I would say that the other way to look at this, we've mentioned this in our brief, I don't want to spend much time on it, but the damage actually to the person in this case, and although the statute says damage to property, the damage that resulted directly to the complaining witness in this case was $1,000 even. That's the amount of out-of-pocket costs that she expended. Those were her costs in her specific damage. So there's another way to think about it, and potentially the General Assembly.
So whether it's a felony or not depends on what deductible you carry with your insurance company?
Well, judges, again, that was an alternative theory of ours that maybe the General Assembly had that in mind, because that, in my experience, $1,000 might be actually a little bit of a high deductible, but there probably are too many deductibles beyond that, although I'm not in any way qualified or an expert to say that. But I think that's possibly some of the reasoning that was injected into the legislature's consideration of the change as well, taking it away from the value.
Counsel, it's Judge Russell again, but doesn't that fly in the face of your theory that they want to make the same amount of damage, the same act, penalized in the same way? Because if there's an out-of-pocket component, it's a felony if I have insurance, and it's not if I it's a felony if I don't have insurance, but if I have insurance, it's not.
I can see that, Your Honor. I can see that. And that's not what we're asking the court to hang the hat on.
You're into your rebuttal. You can continue or reserve as you wish.
I'll reserve, Your Honor.
Ms. Fitzgerald?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. This is Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. The evidence in this case was certainly sufficient to find the defendant caused over $1,000 of damage to the victim's vehicle. The Commonwealth presented two expert witnesses in this case. They are both qualified as experts in assessing the damage to vehicles without objection by the defendant, and their combined estimate was nearly $1,500, $1,484.88. The trial court was certainly entitled to rely on their testimony in finding the statutory threshold was met in this case. And that amount does encompass the repair cost, and that is the appropriate metric in these cases. The Supreme Court held since, I believe, 1977 that the appropriate test for damage to motor vehicle is a reasonable cost of repair. plus, you know, an amount for any depreciation in value that's not encompassed within the repair. We don't have that kind of diminution evidence in this case, but, you know, if we did, it only make the amount go higher.
Counsel, this is Judge Russell.
I apologize, Judge, for talking over you.
It's okay. Is the damage a theoretical damage or an actual damage? Because, of course, if somebody repairs their own car, let's say it has $900 worth of parts for the repair, but repairs their own car, is it would have cost them $1,000? Is that enough, or does it have to have cost somebody $1,000, whether insurance company, et cetera? Did that make sense?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that the cost of repair, whatever the cost may be, is the appropriate metric. And so in a sense that you could certainly put on evidence that, you know, the parts cost this much. I'm a mechanic. You know, I did it myself, and I didn't have to charge for those parts. But had I taken it to a store, you know, it would have been this amount. This is the reasonable repair cost. What we're talking about, I think, is what the reasonable cost of repair may be, which in this case was proven by actual receipts. But I don't know that would be necessary.
This is Judge Johnson. Isn't the better answer that each and every case turns on the proof that's presented in the case? In other words, and what Judge Petty asked earlier of opposing counsel was that there was no evidence presented providing an alternative basis for valuation in this case. And theoretically, if the defendant had come in and said, well, the cost in this matter as presented by the Commonwealth is $1,400. However, we put on proof of our own that suggests that this was an unacceptable amount of money to spend on the repair of this, and actually it could have been done reasonably and proficiently for $150. That would enable the fact finder to make a determination as to which evidence it wanted to believe. Is that the way this is resolved?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree, and I think that goes to the reasonableness, you know, of the repair, and that's a call that trial courts make all the time in the face of competing evidence, in the face of competing valuation.
Ms. Fitzgerald, the introduction of a repair estimate, even if the car is never repaired, be sufficient to meet the, if accepted by the fact finder, be sufficient?
Yes, Your Honor, I would say so, because, again, we're talking about the reasonable cost of repair, and if that's what it would take to repair the car, I don't see a requirement that repair had to have been accomplished within the statute. We're talking about the damage that was caused, and the repair cost just happens to be the metric by which we measure the damage. And so if we're talking about damage, I don't see that there would be a need to have it repaired by the time of trial.
Ms. Fitzgerald, I'm transition into the realm of statutory construction and legislative intent. What do I make of the fact that the General Assembly specifically included the way you prove value under 18.2-137, which is, for want of a better term, damaging personal property, and they did not include it here?
Your Honor, I think a reasonable inference may be that the Averitt case, which came out in 1977, is, we presume the General Assembly is aware of the court's interpretations of its statutes and that definition, and so that case speaks very narrowly to damage to motor vehicles. The statute 18.2-137 talks about other kinds of property, and so I think that it would be reasonable to assume the General Assembly was aware of the court's jurisprudence in this area and didn't see the need.
They basically adopted the Averitt test to apply to other personal property.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that would be a reasonable interpretation there. And surely if the General Assembly meant for a different standard to be used in this case, a different standard, you know, than 137 or than the Averitt test, they certainly could have changed that when they amended the statute to clarify that the damage that we're talking about is, or the value that we're talking about, rather, is the value of the damage rather than the value of the vehicle itself. And I think that statutory amendment there doesn't necessarily speak to the issue that we have in this case, which is the calculation of that damage. I think the amendment probably speaks more to, as the legislative history suggests, you know, what is the item that we're talking about? Is it the damage to the vehicle, or is it how much the vehicle itself was worth? And I think everyone agrees we're talking about the value of the damage rather than the value of the item that was damaged. And I think it's significant that's a different valuation than we have in, for example, grand larceny cases, where we're talking about the market value of an item, valued at a certain amount. Here we're talking about the value of damages. So it makes sense that repair costs, you know, in like the bicycle case, for example, that was brought up earlier, here we're talking about the value of the damage instead of the value of the item that was stolen or that was damaged. But similarly to those grand larceny cases, we can fight about the valuation. Counsel certainly had the opportunity at trial to cross-examine the Commonwealth's experts, you know, regarding whether this was a reasonable cost for repair, whether these parts could have been acquired differently. And I think that Damiani, the expert at 54 and 55 in the appendix, talks about how these parts were mostly aftermarket parts and that he thought he had gotten the best price he could get, and that list price was list price for certain elements of this car that had to be replaced. So certainly the trial court had that evidence before it and could determine, you know, based on his testimony, that he made a reasonable effort to find these parts and that this was a reasonable cost of repair. Certainly there was no competing expert testimony offered, and the defendant had the ability to offer that testimony had he wished to challenge the Commonwealth's evidence on that point. And also, the defendant had the ability to cross-examine these witnesses for bias. I think it was discussed earlier that, you know, maybe we take this car to a place that we know is going to charge more, you know, for some reason if someone has a sinister motive behind that, and certainly that kind of bias could also come out in cross-examination, the same in a criminal case as it would in a civil case. So I think the concerns about subjectivity in this case are solved by relying on the fact finder to make these kind of credibility determinations, as we do in other similar cases. So I'd be happy to answer questions that the court has. I think that the Commonwealth's expert testimony in this case was sufficient to meet and exceed that statutory threshold. And if there are no further questions, I would ask you to affirm.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dunovich, you've got your 2 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. I'll be brief. I think after hearing the Commonwealth and after all the questions from your honors, part of this certainly goes back to Judge Russell's first hypothetical, and I'm not sure that any ruling on this case is necessarily going to fix every problem that could be created by this statute, the wording as is, although I would submit that this, the intent of the legislature was certainly to clarify, as it says in the summary of the House bill notes. And when I say that, I mean if you hit a Ferrari, you might have higher costs associated with that repair, both in parts and labor, than you would a 1970 Yugo. So even the way the statute's written now doesn't correct it all the way, because that person would still probably clip over the 1,000 with the Ferrari much easier than they would the Yugo, a similar fact pattern that we have in this present case. But the intent of the legislature was certainly to divert away from looking at the value of the vehicle or the property that was injured, so that, like Judge Russell was hypothetical, if you hit the Mercedes, you're not automatically going to be a felon, because certainly that was over $1,000 vehicle versus hitting a Trek bicycle that's worth $500. The intent of the legislature was to reduce the number of individuals that were being convicted of felonies under the statute, and I think in furtherance of that, Your Honor, this particular situation could have gone a lot of different ways. If the defendant had run into a different vehicle and the complaining witness had taken it to a different shop, perhaps we're not here today. And I know that that's a lot of supposition at this point, but we feel that we did put on some competing evidence, at least in our questions to Joel Damiani, and that based upon the lack of clarity in the current statute, we're asking this court to consider distinguishing the statute, interpreting the statute a certain way, and not finding that Mr. Cock was guilty of a felony in this particular circumstance, because the Commonwealth failed to prove that there was $1,000 of damage to the property in this particular case. Thank you, Your Honors, for hearing us today.
Thank you very much. The case is concluded. Mr. Dunham, would you remain on the line, though, until we...